irishradio.com, worldwide, best way to reach us, of course, is info@irishradio.com. My own and my family's association with the Maguires goes back decades, before I left Ireland and for long afterwards. The Western people was owned and operated by Jim Maguire, so we grew up with the Western people. And then I, for many, many years here, Jim's daughter, Siobhan Maguire, was indeed manager of the law firm here of O'Dwyer and Bernstein. And today I welcome Conor Maguire. And his Conor, best known for his paintings, he is the lead columnist for the Western People, still going full belt, going strong in my native Ballina in County Mayo. But let me welcome Conor Maguire to the program. Conor, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Adrian. Lovely to speak to you.
Best known as an artist, as a painter. How did you start in that field?
Well, I always painted since I was a child. I suppose it was encouraged when I was younger. I had an aunt who was a very good painter, and so it was quickly picked up that I enjoyed it, and I used to help her out, and I sort of picked up the skill, and from that I decided it was something I wanted to study, which I did in the College of Art and Design. And from there I went into design, and the painting took a back seat for a while, but then you know, you reach a state in life where you say either you're going to do what you want or you're never going to do it. So I went back to painting sort of seriously about 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, and had my own little studio. And I've been modestly successful, if not busy. So it's Irish work, Irish landscapes, and I concentrate on Irish themes,
Well, before you get too modest, here you are indeed. Some of your paintings, including the Galway Hooker at Sea, the Blasket Islands in Kerry, the Killarney pontoon sunset, which should have come fairly easy to you. That's only out the road from Ballina.
On the way home,
Some of them, indeed, the originals go for a couple of $1,000, but they're, I think we could go to Fine Art America, we could go to Amazon and get and see about your paintings. When I said best known for your paintings, that is not indeed taking away from the Maguire legacy of journalism. Tell us a bit about the history of the Maguires and the Western people.
Well, my late dad, now 3 years passed away. When he did finally retire a year before he died, he was the longest serving journalist in the country. He died at the age of, my goodness, is it 81? I could be corrected for that. but he had been editor for quite a few years and worked in various papers. But of course, he always was known for his Mayo connection and brought, I suppose, the Western people to where it is today as a leading provincial paper. But he did retire as editor, but kept a column going for years into his retirement, right up to a year before he passed away. So just as by association, I suppose, myself and my brother, because he needed help with correcting, I suppose, and typing up and all the sort of things that were beyond him, including navigating email and attachments and all that. We used to do that for him. So I sort of fell into that sort of accidentally, if you like, of editing what he did and writing up what he did to, you know, get it ready for paper. So I got to know the process, you know, of writing a column and how we went about it. So it hadn't actually occurred to me that I would do it, except on his anniversary, I was going to put something in to the paper about him, and I said, well, why would I put in a small paragraph when for so many years he filled the paper with pages of print? So I set about doing something substantial, you know, and did a lot of research and did a two-page spread of my memories of my father, if you like. So it was a sort of a very personal piece, but it went down very well, and as a consequence, the now editor, James Laffey, said, would I be interested in doing a column? And I sort of said, well, why not? So that's 3 years ago, and I'm still doing it, and it's now a staple part of the weekly fare in the paper. So these things come around on their own time, you know.
Absolutely.
It was never a sort of a decision, you know, it just happened. Yeah.
I think that if we take the town of Ballina, and even
yeah.
though I was bred and buttered in Attymass, I was the first member of the family. Actually
yeah.
born in Ballina, so I can claim.
Well, we share that.
Now, you have done a lot of research on many topics, but on the Great Irish Hunger, or the famine, which wiped out a million plus people in Ireland. You in your research, the notion of a novel, in your case, a novel called The Hunger House, you indeed took a poetic license, as it were, on a subject that is far from light. It is one of the greatest
daunting.
Really a daunting subject. But just bring us back to you know, your own research on the famine and how, in particular, it brought us into what's now the Wild Atlantic Way, into the west of Ireland, and even narrowed down somewhat to our own neck of the woods.
Yeah, try to put it briefly. I have family associations on my mother's side with the now demolished workhouse in Ballina, which was built along with innumerable other workhouses in Ireland around 1838, before the famine. They had no idea what was coming, of course, but these were poor houses, if you like, and the one in Ballina was one of the largest in the country, and it was built to house 1,200 people. They never foresaw, I think, that it would be full to capacity or that it would be overwhelmed, but, you know, history tells us otherwise. But I had originally thought I would do something specifically on the famine, and so was sort of gung-ho to do that and set about trying to weave my own family history into a story of the workhouse in the era of the famine. But as I said, it was so daunting and so overwhelming and so unrelentingly awful. All the stories, all the accounts I read, the histories, the private histories, the public histories, there was nothing to give life. There was nothing to give romance. There was nothing that would make a story palatable to the ordinary reader. And so I sort of nearly gave up in despair and thought, God, this is just too much. And also have been done by other, you know, more seriously, if you like, by academics, you know. So the stories were there, and if you really want to approach the famine, you can get deep into it and come away very angry, you know. So just as a notion, I went back further, you know. I said, well, you know, just visit the area pre-famine, you know. And it's a neglected time because the event of the famine was so overwhelming and so writ large in our consciousness. The period previous to it is very much forgotten. And
right.
It turned out to be a fascinating time. And
not only is it forgotten, but we know very little about it.
Yes.
And I think you might agree that you know, that period in Ireland,
yeah,
was not a sexy period. It was a part of our history that we can't relate to without feeling a tinge of sorrow, of embarrassment, of guilt, none of which we should, but that's, I think that is something that is peculiar to the Irish, and for good reasons, considering that we have, you know, 800 years of oppression.
Yeah.
And so it's not something that we would, you know, purposely pull out and highlight, but it is indeed... you have taken an approach which is somewhat brings us to more acceptability, as it were. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the period just previous to the famine, you know, Ireland wasn't that different from other countries in Europe, because, you know, there was poverty in all countries. There was destitution, but there was also a vibrant merchant class, professional classes, and then you had, of course, the aristocracy and the landed and the people who held the strings of power. And Ireland wasn't very different, and there was a status quo, you know. You had hardship, but you also had, in towns like Ballina, you had industry, and you had a professional class, you had a merchant class. So the thing with the sort of, you know, in inverted brackets, the potato famine, the potato seems to loom large, but there are so many other strands to this tragedy. And while the very, very poor, if you like, at the base of the pyramid, who had been forced into dependency, that's another thing that really annoys me, the portrayal of the Irish as potato eaters. They were forced into eating potatoes because all the other food was taken in tax, you know, like if they had grains, if they had pigs, if they had chickens, if they had cattle, that was paid tax. And then they were forced into a fatal, if you like, dependency on the potato. And that was the great tragedy. When it failed, there was nothing else. There was other food, but that was still exported. Anyway, I digress. But when the famine hit, What struck me about researching Ballina and places like that is how vibrant they were. And we were, as a country, on the cusp of similar prosperity and industrialization and sophistication as even Britain was. But what happened with the famine is that, you know, as we know, it's decimated the population. A million people emigrated, a million died. So over a period of 5-6 years, the population was halved. And we never recovered, because that progression from that size population and the infrastructure that would have been needed, that was growing, was stopped short. So there was this hiatus in Ireland's development. And while other countries plowed ahead, unfortunately, because of the trauma of the famine, our population never recovered. Our industry and our infrastructure never grew. I don't know if I'm making sense, but, you know, it's a far deeper issue.
Absolutely.
And that's what this period that I dealt with. It shows an Ireland that was much more sophisticated culturally, economically, in every other way, then you have to remember that a new cathedral had just been built in Ballinara. Two new bridges had just been built across the Moy. A road had just been built to Sligo. There was tobacco manufacture, there was linen manufacture, they were exporting fish to Paris and London. So it was a tremendously vibrant society. Yeah. That was wiped out.
Ballinara would have been considered somewhat a garrison town.
It was a garrison town, yeah. Not a large garrison. It wouldn't have been as large a garrison as, say, Castlebar, but it was still a considerable, they had a very considerable presence in the town, yes. Yeah.
So when we look and when we speak of the famine of the great hunger, we tend to look across the pond, and many would lay blame on Mother England and what they could and couldn't do. But bring us to Ballinara town. You have all of this industrial prosperity and exports and whatever. Would those who were starving, those who were dying from hunger, wouldn't they have looked at Ballinara town itself and saying they wouldn't be looking at Mother England, they would not be looking at the crown, they would be looking in their own backyard and saying, this is horrific, this is
absolutely.
Absolutely.
And again, how long do we have? It gets so complex, and the strands again, of what made this tragedy so awful are so multiple. You know, you could spend another half an hour on this theme alone.
Right.
And one thing we forget is that the blight or the potato famine wasn't just an Irish phenomenon. That the blight crossed Europe. So. The blight that had such devastating effects in Ireland also affected other countries in Europe, but they didn't suffer to the same degree because the authorities acted responsibly and they gave relief and dealt with the famine immediately, if you like. You know, it was a potential famine in other countries. But Ireland was unique in that, first, its over-dependency on the potato, but also how the authorities reacted to it. And here, this is a debate you hear of was it a planned genocide? And I don't think it actually was, but it was neglect by intent. You know, once it had started to unfold, they sort of turned a blind eye. And I think it was
very
the Lord Chancellor.
Yeah, but it's very thin line there. Between neglect and genocide, that will forever be be interpreted.
You had the attitude, I'd say, Trevelyan. He was, I think, it was the Lord Chancellor, and he would have been quoted as saying he was a God-fearing man, as he would have put it then, and he looked on the Irish famine, even though it was man-made and it was manufactured by human neglect, he looked on it as a divine punishment. The Irish were reprobate, and he looked on it as sent from God, which is a twisted thinking by our standards. And, you know, I don't do intergenerational guilt to people who suffer and the people who allow this tragedy. They're all gone, you know, and we have to move on.
Right.
But it could have been avoided, you know. So the time that I deal with in the novel, I end, if you like, on a note of one of the main characters, who's the matron in the workhouse, sort of walking down the hill and running her hands over the stalks of the potatoes, and she's heard rumors of crop failures down south, and she reassures herself in a sort of internal dialogue that, you know, the Irish are tough, that while things might go wrong, they'll be okay. And, you know, I leave the novel on the cusp of this calamity, if you like, about to overtake them. And sort of left the door open, if you like, yeah, for further writing.
Did a good job in that. But bring us now to the guts of your book, The Hunger House. Whereas it's a novel and an easy read, and it is a different, definitely one would say that it is, with all that has been written and spoken about the Irish famine, your novel leads us up to the event itself. But this character, I just want to talk a little bit about your main character, Bridget Hennigan, who returns to Ballina. Where was she? Where was she before?
She was from Foxford, and she went to Dublin to study nursing under Catherine McCauley with the just newly founded Sisters of Mercy. And through circumstance, the job comes up in Ballina, and she's suited for the post. And her husband comes, which was often the case in workhouses, it was a husband and wife team who were master and matron, and they occupied either a house or an apartment in the workhouse and ran it and lived in it and worked as a team. So in the novel, her husband-to-be gets offered the job as master, and he says, they're looking for, we need a matron, you're ideally placed. So on that basis, she comes back and takes, at a very young age, on the administration, mostly of the female, because it was segregated, of course, the female section. So it's fictitious, but it has its roots in reality, if you like, I fleshed out the story with imaginings, which you have to do,
How would a matron, how would the management of the workhouse, would that have been to, was there favoritism in, you're talking about, 1,200 inmates, as they were, because they were actually, they were slaves.
They were. Of course, when I say it had a capacity for 1,200, it was very slowly filled, and even before, and right actually into the beginning of the famine, it was still partly empty, because there was a huge stigma attached to going to the workhouse, and I also deal with that in the book through personal histories. It was seen as, for a man to enter, because you had to enter, you couldn't enter and keep your property. You became a ward of the state, which means you were to all degrees a prisoner. You surrendered any property you had. You surrendered care of your family. So you entered with all your family, a wife and husband and children, and then they were instantly segregated. So the children didn't see their parents, and the husband and wife were in male and female sections. This was terribly, terribly punitive, and intentionally so. It was intended as a deterrent, because they didn't want people entering on the idea that they'd just get a free board, but it was meant to be punishing, and it was dreadfully punishing.
What about the children? Poverty and hopelessness for those who would turn over their meager holdings to enter the workhouse. So what is the what was the scene like? So you had young children in there. Were they conditioned to the workhouse? Was there a relief? There a point where they said, okay, you're out of here?
Well, yeah, the father would have to sign them out if they survived, again, there was, we are talking 1840s, late 1830s, the fever and sickness were rife, so there would have been a very high mortality rate if, something like scarlet fever or some other virulent disease enters, in close proximity, hundreds could die, so this is how life was. But if a family wants to enter, they had to go first to a relieving officer who took their details, and then their case was brought before a board of governors who sat once a week, who then looked at their case and either gave them admittance or not. And once they were admitted, as I said, they became a ward of the Queen or the state, and surrendered everything, and so entered into, if you like, very difficult labour. The men broke stones, the women did a lot of the menial work around the house, and the children were sometimes educated or just fed or held in dormitories, and there was very little by way of comfort, if nothing, and it was dreaded. Of course, the idea of entering the workhouse was a dreaded notion.
And but it was, for all intents and purposes, it was male-dominated?
Yes. Now, of course, you had a matron and master and matron over the actual institution, but the boards would have been predominantly male professional or professional class. There might have been perhaps the wife of maybe a barrister or a wife of the local gentry on the board, but yeah, it would have been largely male dominated. So very little room for female sympathy. I think they would have been constricted by rules as well. There was a very strict set of rules which governed all the institutions, and you did have variations in places, and of course if the personalities of the master and matron had a great deal to do with the daily workings of the workhouse. But then a lot of the work was done, like I have scenes in the book of the reception area where people were brought in, and they would have been tended to by other inmates, say other female inmates or male inmates, and they would have been hardened people too, you know, so they were all in this together. This is a very tough regime, so it's a pretty terrifying place to enter, you know. The psychology of it, I can't imagine the effect it would have on the mind of a child and the development of a child, but to be separated from your parents knowing they're just the other side of the building and you're not allowed to see them must have been quite terrifying, yeah.
So without giving us, too many details.
Yeah.
your book, The Hunger House, carries us through the emotions, a lot of emotions, including, anger and indeed the morality of of the undertaking, again with Bridget Hennigan, the matron, and the strained, one could say, and putting it lightly, the strained relationship with the resident medical officer, this Dr. White. It's a very striking book, and one that I think it's a good read, because it does bring us to, to another aspect, and one that we know very little about, other than the shame of and the destitution and of winding up in the workhouse in the first place. You're taking a great, whereas it's a novel and a very good one, it rides pretty close to the bone.
You can go on again about the nature of an historical novel, and some people would see it as taking license with history. And, it's not an academic study of the period. But to me, it's something we all do. You know, I love history. And even if you go and you visit old ruins or an abbey or something, you always bring your imagination with you. You know, you walk into an abbey or an old building, the first thing that comes into play is your imagination. You start to imagine characters or what it might have been like 2 centuries ago, if it's what it might have been like with its roof on when it was fully occupied. So even in its coldest sense, when you visit a place of history, your imagination is involved. You can't help that. It's history and imagination are intertwined, and that's what makes it fascinating. So, you know, some might say, you know, that the historical novel is a device, and they might try and invalidate it as an authentic device. But I think it is, because it's what we do. I'm just pushing it that bit further. You're using your imagination to flesh out a story. And if you do it properly and you do your research, it's as valid a way as any of telling history, you know, and often much more vivid way of telling history. And people, it gets into people's minds much more vividly than a cold historical academic treatise, if you like, you know.
Yeah.
And I tried to keep the historical details extremely accurate. I did the research on the buildings, on the habits, on the people. And so I don't think you'll find anything in it that way that would lead you astray. But the conversations are imagined, the situations are imagined. But they're also referred from stuff I read, you know, that these were situations that were not uncommon. And abuse was rife. You know, that's another thing there was. Again, it was a male-dominated institution, and you were at the mercy, and, you know, really, your an inmate's word against anybody in authority would not hold sway, you know. So people were very vulnerable, and they had no voice. So it was...
We learned about the book from fellow Ballinaites, George Waters,
a very good friend of my father's, and subsequently of mine, you know. I'm regularly in contact with George,
and of course he
liked the book very much, so.
And our quite famous Ballina man here in the United States, John Garvey. But let's get to how we get the book itself. The book is The Hunger House by Connor McGuire, my guest. Best way to get the book?
Okay. Is Amazon, really. I have it distributed, physical copy in Ireland, but if you want to get it in America, which I hope people will, you can order a physical copy on Amazon, or you can download directly to your Kindle or your reading device, an e-book. So it's there. If you look it up on Amazon, it's awaiting your inspection.
Terrific. Okay. Thank you for joining us. And I want to end on something that has nothing to do with the famine. Nothing to do with anything but other than the fact that we're gearing up for a win in the All-Ireland final.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about
the
hope. We've had quite a few disappointments, but atmosphere like now?
Well, I think we're very proud at the moment, because, you know, we have an absolutely fantastic Mayo team, and this is, I think, their seventh attempt, which... You know, they're in the top three of the teams in the country, and they are giants of the sport, and heroes, and they're heroes in my eyes. Whether they win or not, I still think they're heroes. They are just so dedicated, and they have given us the most thrilling football again and again and again. And they might go through troughs, but they come back, like as in last Monday in the replay. It was a thrilling match, and for us, maybe not for Roscommon, but they just came back and showed us that just the quality of the sportsmanship from the Mayo team is exemplary, and we're so proud of them. And please God, the imaginary curse will lift, and Sam McGuire will come back to Mayo, especially for this team, because they have been just, I think, giants of the sport, and so it's in the lap of the gods. But they're so talented and so gifted, and such lovely guys, lovely sportsmen, lovely people, and they're good, clean sportsmen too, and we're very proud of them. So yeah, we hope for the best.
Yeah, all right. And if the Sam McGuire is going to Mayo, Mayo will be bulging. There won't be room.
Mayo will burst at the seams.
Burst at the seams. Okay, I've had a cousin Dr. Louis Byrne from Kilkelly. Yeah. And he's going to burst at the seams if they don't win. Well, Conor
McGregor will. Yeah.
Okay.
And Diaspora as well will probably we'll just. I don't think we'll work for a few days after. We'll be so high.
We'll work at all.
Yeah. Please God, first, you know, if they bring us to the final, I'm still so proud of them, and you know. They're amazing. I think they're amazing, and they'll give us a good day's sport, no matter what, you know.
Terrific. Okay, Conor McGuire, The Hunger House. The Hunger House by Conor McGuire. Get it on Amazon.
Okay.